Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi there, I'm Janet. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
Janet, what is a podcast?
It's like the radio, but there's no music, and literally anyone can do one at any moment about any subject. And there's a billion of them.
Sounds great. Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we're discussing Season 1, Episode 6, What We Owe to Each Other. It was directed by Tucker Gates and features guest cast Mary Holland, Merrill Hathaway, and Rebecca Delgado-Smith. To recap, Michael enlists Eleanor to help him investigate what's wrong with the neighborhood. She tries to fulfill her promise of helping him while not actually helping him realize she's the problem. He ultimately concludes that he is the problem. Chidi agrees to third wheel a date between Tahani and Jianyu at a spa. He ends up Cyrano-ing Tahani to make her happy. My guests today are the writers of the episode, Josh Siegel and Dylan Morgan. Josh and Dylan, welcome. Everything is fine.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you're here. First things first, has this podcast become the envy of the writer's room?
It's weird. You'd think that we'd all be good friends at this point because a lot of us have been on multiple seasons, but we're bitter enemies.
Of course.
And
it shows in the writing.
Yeah. And so it's nice to rub this in someone else's face that they haven't been on yet.
I bring this up because it is my understanding that Jen Statsky debriefs everybody that comes back to the writer's room going like, how was it? Is it fun? It must be nice to be asked.
Jen gave us a hard time as we left. Uh-huh. And we're excited for her to hear this part.
Okay. Very good. Very good. So you've been on since season one, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you write as a duo. You're a writing team.
That's right. Yeah.
How does this differ, this show that takes place in the afterlife, writing for both humans and non-humans, predominantly non-humans, I suppose. How does this differ from other things that you've done?
I mean, the biggest difference, especially season one, was that there was a big reveal that we had to hide the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really complicated. The whole time we had to keep in mind the idea that Michael is, everything that he's doing is an act, that we can never have a scene with him and not have one of the four, you know, imprisoned leads in the scene.
Because it would be him twisting his mustache and cackling.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? He wouldn't act. He's putting on a play for them, and so he can't have any scenes that are not like that. And it created a lot of hoops we had to jump through, but ultimately.
Even Janet. I mean, to be alone with Janet is the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's funny going back and watching this episode. Now we're in the middle of breaking and writing season three. It doesn't feel like.
What's that about?
No, well, I'm not allowed, but it feels like a different show. It feels like Ted was only allowed to paint in like a couple of the colors, that he is now free to just like be completely himself and engaging and also scared. And it's great. I mean, it was fun to see that we had to like keep a secret, but now it just gets to be this almost like a different character gets to be on the show. It's fun.
I'm going to skip ahead by an entire season. And when you say scared, one of my favorite moments, I think, from the show is the end of an episode in season two when the train pulls away and they're lying underneath and they all pop up and Eleanor and Michael make eye contact and he looks evil briefly and then says, "You guys!" Like that's, I mean, those are the shades you're describing.
Like yeah.
He's got so many, you know, such a vivid palette.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So this is a very interesting, there's a theme in this episode that basically is if you make a promise, live up to it. And you know, Eleanor especially is exploring like how to make both happen, how to help and not help at the same time. Do either of you have a background in philosophy? How much of the Scanlon book, What We Owe to Each Other, were you aware of? I understand you were sometimes briefed by philosophy heavy hitters.
Yeah. I mean, I am a world-class dummy. I mean, like, for real, for sure. Like,
that's great. Me too.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's – and I'm always terrified to watch the conversation go sailing over my head when it comes to the philosophy stuff.
Sure.
Mike is super interested in it and very gifted at boiling down these big ideas to their essential ideas and – suggesting how they'll be funny. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we read a little bit of Scanlon and we...
Does it read? I mean, can you... Is it drab?
Well, it's not even...
It's not...
It's just a lot of like $30 words
okay.
to describe something that, oh, this is what Mike was talking about in two sentences.
Is $30 a lot?
Well, for a word?
Okay.
For a single word? Yeah.
I guess when you talk about like 50 cent words.
Or yeah, okay. Exactly.
So $30, that's up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm not... I wouldn't pay more
okay.
than that. But so he's gifted at that. But the fun thing about this show is that not only does Chidi get to talk about this stuff, Eleanor gets to respond to it. Mm-hmm. And
Eleanor gets to respond.
Yeah, exactly. And so every time Eleanor is like, please, can this be easier? Mm-hmm. Why is this so dumb? Why is this so hard to understand? Can you just like allow me to see this in cartoon form?
Right.
That's a little bit, I think, I'll speak for myself. That's me. Talking to Chidi and begging the show to be just a little bit dumber and slower.
Is there a video I could watch instead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
A little bit. Things like that. Lines like, despite your constant mockery, which I think is another delicious favorite of mine
yeah.
in this episode, but in the series as a whole. And the distilled things are that because you are the people that shepherded and wrote this episode, are those your voices in this?
Yeah. I mean, I think our voices, I mean, you know, the room is a very special place. The writer's room is a really exciting, you know, when I rewatch this episode, I see obviously tons of us because we're, you know, the writers and we're shepherding this thing. You also see, oh, that's Mike in there. I see Joe and Jen and Megan, all other writers, Aisha, who was there first season. You just see lots of different people.
In what? In terms of phrase, in bits, in...
Yeah, in jokes, in ideas, in something that tickled them, and the fact that it tickled them got Mike really excited about it. So it's cool to see all of those voices present. You know, that first scene, you know, was something that we wrote great big chunks of, and I remember being especially excited that there's this throwaway line that Eleanor says when she's mocking Chidi, which is very quickly she says, "Whatever, you love it." And you know, that was us, and that was just like she was very excited to say it. It felt like it really was like underlining a tone that was going to be part of their relationship moving forward.
It's a defining moment of her character.
Yeah,
like it's like I'm a jerk. I recognize it. I also am not sorry.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I do recognize it. Moving on.
Yeah.
She also physically turns away at that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the level of vulnerability that she's willing to show.
Like right.
That's her caring as much as she can.
And pretend all you like, you don't hate it as much as you are acting like you do, Chidi.
Right.
I'm pretty entertaining,
yeah.
is what she's able to say in that moment. So like that was like a little thing. And plenty of times you throw those things in and they can get just like wiped away or Mike left it in, and Kristen hit it out of the park, and it was just adorable.
It really is an Eleanor Shellstrop, like, boilerplate, and I don't mean, like, trite. I mean, like, that's who she is.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Both of you nodded when you said that the writer's room is a special place. is this writer's room different than others you've been in? I visited last week and was horribly intimidated.
It's funny. It definitely is a different place than any place we've worked. But in a way that I think is, I was surprised by your reaction. It has the highest level of empathy in any half hour comedy writer's room that I've been in. Mike is sets a tone and an example for everybody. And I don't think, no, I think that I am breaking dugout rules by telling you that more than half the staff calls him daddy.
Oh, wow.
And he hates it. He hates
it. Should we bump to break?
Yeah.
How to handle that information?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. No, he hates it. But you know, there's a reality that he's a super empathetic guy who, found a bunch of people who have strong opinions and strong voices that come from different areas. And he is in the middle of all of them. And, he knows how to like find the things that everyone is really good at and everyone's special. And like, yeah, it's, it is, you know, like any comedy writer's room, also super mean. But it's the nicest of that I can imagine.
Right. Because I think that, it's a Darwinian ensemble, right? A writer's room, any writer's room. Like, you are collaborating, but also you're going to get your episode in, right? And you're going to fight for your jokes, right? You're going to fight for your bits.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're going to fight, but it's also like, it's interesting because, I mean, laughter is such a great equalizer when it comes to that. You know, 9 times out of 10, if it's right for the show, you've said it in a funny way, the room is laughing. Mm-hmm. It becomes like, it becomes very clear it's the right answer for this moment. Unless, you know, your boss, I'm not going to call him daddy, but unless your boss decides
you,
like...
You did.
No. Well...
He doesn't do that.
I don't do that. I love him like a brother, though, not like a daddy.
We'll be right back.
Like an older brother, like a daddy-type brother.
But yeah, I mean, you know, so luck. The hope is that like it's competitive and collaborative at the same time. And
to forge it, to put it in a crucible and make it better, right?
Yeah. And you get people who are from wildly different backgrounds, have different senses of humor, but there's one bullseye that the showrunner has painted, and then we're all going to try and hit it in our own unique way. And so as much as you're arguing or trying to talk over each other, it's also just like, at its best, it can feel like, you know, 10-year-olds having a sleepover, like that you're just like giddy with laughter that your friends are like, whether it's on topic or not on topic, just to keep the energy up, you know, when it reaches those heights, it's really exciting. Cool.
Until daddy comes to the top of the stairs and says, lights out, get in your sleeping bags.
I did walk into that.
Yeah. No. I will use this information for the remainder of my time on this planet. Lizzie is a writer's assistant, and she has said that, like, because when I walked in the other day, it was you all around a giant coffee table on 4 couches and lots of chairs, 14 or 15 of you or whatever. And it's my understanding that you spend a significant portion of your day in that gaggle, or what do you refer to that? Is that the room? What do you call that? Because you all have offices that sort of surround it, right?
The couches, I guess, is what we call it.
Yeah. Well, there's two forms of the room on this show. The couch is where we're sort of talking about things generally, giving notes on scripts and pitching on story ideas. Mm-hmm. And then behind that is the computers, where there's, 14 monitors but one keyboard, and we're all sitting around.
Wait, is that true?
Yeah. And so there's 14 monitors and one keyboard, and the showrunner or someone he has selected – we'll sit at the keyboard. We'll all be looking at the script together, and we'll just be pitching out ideas and jokes from behind those monitors. And if it's funny and it's correct, then he'll put it in the script, or whoever's at the keyboard will put it in the script.
And if it's not funny, you get shocked? Is that – am I picturing the right
– Yeah, there's ejector scenes. Yeah.
This is fascinating. I have never heard of this before. Is this a common practice in writers' rooms?
I think it is. There's different kind of schools. I know that I'm fairly sure they – did the same exact system on Parks.
Okay.
We were from most of our history is a different leg of we, you know, we were on 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt before that. And their system there.
So nothing good.
Nothing good.
No good shows.
Very bad
thing.
Yeah. It was the only difference, real difference, was a projector instead of 14 monitors.
Okay.
So you'd see.
It's cheaper on monitors.
Yeah, the screen would be the wall, essentially, and you'd look at the script up there, and then you're just all, you know, essentially pitching.
But the script that's on there that's being worked on collaboratively is not a blank page to begin. It's the draft that you submitted, right, based on what you were charged with saying, like, this episode needs to accomplish the following, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, if it's worth going through, it's like the process will be, there'll be the kernel of an idea that can kind of come from anyone. Often it'll come from Mike, or Mike in a, you know, working with a room full of people, figuring out what's going to happen next. We'll talk about that idea for days until we have cards on a board that suggests what every scene is going to be. Someone will go off and write from those cards what he calls a Goldilocks document, where you're boiling.
Say that word again?
Yeah, Goldilocks. Like the, again, this is really leaning into the fact that he's our daddy, but like the, he, it's, I didn't realize how much.
I think the Goldilocks idea, I think, is that it's supposed to be written in the style of like, they went into the room, they looked for the thing, and not, it's not really ornate, and it's trying to be bare bones story.
Right. Can you boil down this episode we're trying to write to as if it could fit in a children's book?
Great.
So then that Goldilocks document will come back, that we'll go to the couches, we'll all discuss it, we'll make changes into the ideas or whatever. Then the writer of the episode will go off and turn that into an outline. Mm-hmm. And the outline is just a fatter version of that Goldilocks document, but with jokes you want to throw in, breaking it down into scenes, making it feel more like an episode. Then we'll go back to the couches. We'll talk about that. Then someone will go off and write an actual draft.
The writer of the episode, typically? Or
writer of the episode will write their own draft. On this show, sometimes that draft just goes back to the room for notes and thoughts and pitches. But on this show, Mike will then take those drafts, he'll do his own pass. He'll protect you from the jokes that
he'll
break this show, and you know
he'll execute executive privilege over.
Yeah,
he'll
yeah.
put the X to some things. Okay,
yeah,
he's the picker.
He's the picker, right?
Daddy picker, yeah. Picker daddy.
Yes, daddy is the picker.
I don't like it. So then that draft will go to the whole staff. We'll go back to the couches. We'll talk about it, and then we'll go to the computers and we'll finalize the episode. And, you know, then it has a life after that where we're doing table reads and fixing things after that. But, you know, that's sort of the process from couch to computer.
That's wild. I had no idea about this Bloomberg terminal, 14 monitors, yeah. One keyboard kind of.
Yeah.
Is every keystroke on that keyboard a red hot ladle down your throat? Is like, do you go like, it's perfect?
What do you mean? Just like.
Like any edit. Any addition or subtraction, like where you're like, we really liked that.
Well, actually, compared to other places we've been, Mike still does a really good job valuing the things that are even getting cut on other shows. Usually have two documents open. One is the script and the other is a kind of clipboard of stuff that's getting cut out.
I can picture that, sure.
And on most shows that we worked on, it was called like scrap. The other. But on this show, it's the candy bag.
Oh, we've talked about the candy bag with Lizzie. Candy yes, bag. Yes, yes.
Right. Yeah. So that's an adorable way to protect someone's feelings.
Yeah.
No, it's Mike does a great job of like making sure everyone's energy stays up. And sometimes that is we need to goof off. And sometimes that is, okay, get back to it.
Yeah. Mike has a soundboard of, and I think it must have like 40 or 50 things on it that he is queued up perfectly from YouTube so that when he clicks on it, the computer will immediately say something that is a thing that we've laughed about or been annoyed about or hated in the past.
You're describing a morning zoo radio show.
It is like that. Yeah. Okay. And he's really good at it. and I think a lot of time it's used as a palate cleanser too. Like if it's and as a time waster, like when we
Wait
don't want to work.
It's from Parks. It's the something in the douche. It's
a little bit,
right?
A little bit that.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
But it's things collected just from his love of all pop culture. And yeah, it's pretty goofy.
Joe Mandy referred, I think, to something that everybody was saying, maybe from one of Manny Jacinto's auditions or something. Like it's things like even from within the show, right? That get sort of viralized and repeated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Mike had talked about wanting the character to be from the beginning starting as stupider than Chris Pratt was at the end of Parks.
Wow.
So like starting there and getting stupider.
Sure.
But I think it was, yeah, it was originally talked, and this is a while ago, and it was always a big discussion, but as more of a bro, and then his audition kind of defined for us. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how other people would describe it. Like, there's a playful childishness, and he's very innocent in that way. And yeah, it's a lot of it is from what we at least projected onto him from that audition. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he could be in real life a monster.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But in that interview, he was a little baby.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Getting back to this episode in particular. This is the first time that we ever see out of control Michael. He's unshaven, his tie's undone. I love that you picked as the universal signifier of like despair a gray zip up hoodie. You're both wearing gray zip up garments at the moment. Are you all right?
Yeah.
That was very personal for me because it is a comforting thing. I think probably more from when I was like 8, but it's still like basically what being inside the womb is imagined to be like is
it's yeah,
pulling
pajamas.
It over your head and then pulling the hoodie thing tight so there's just a little tiny hole and the world can't hurt you from outside.
There was a moment on set where Dylan and I were behind the monitor and Dylan turned to me and said, he's not pulling it tight enough. He's got to. People aren't going to get it. People aren't going to get what he's feeling if he doesn't pull it so tight that he can only put his one eye through it. I'm like, we'll get it. We'll get it, man. Don't worry.
It's such a fascinating bit of theater that Michael's doing at the top of this episode, too, when he's got his own sort of, not torture matrix in this instance, but the matrix of trying to say, like, where do these things, you know, what's out of control? I missed something. Something must. And obviously, it's all pretense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. So scenes like that were, like, fun to write. It's like, and he is so gifted, especially when you get to go back and rewatch it.
You're suggesting Ted Danson's good at it.
I think he's fine. I think he's... I haven't seen any of his other stuff, so I don't know. But in this, he seems good.
He's never heard him before this.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I mean, he finds so many different levels. And, like, we would, you know, just – and, you know, on set, when he's doing those things, that first season, nobody on the crew, nobody knows. Kristen knows the secret. He knows the secret. The writers know the secret.
The secret you're referring to is the episode 113 twist that this is, in fact – the bad place.
Yeah, exactly. We had directors who weren't even, you know.
Oh my gosh, I've never even considered that.
Yeah. So, you know, and Mike chose to tell who he told. I think we as writers were just so terrified of telling
anyone. Would have known early on. He was seminal. Yeah. But there were directors that directed entire episodes early in season one that did not know episode 113.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were those kind of conversations we had to have where it would be like, they're like, maybe we just exit them before... you know, in blocking the scene. Like, maybe we exit, you know, Tahani or whoever, and then she's like, well, we can't, and I can't tell you why not.
Mike can tell you.
That happened. Yeah. You had to say, or writers were...
Yeah, there was conversations where we had to pretend.
Yeah, can we start the scene with just Janet and Michael talking, and then whatever, and it's like...
Not really.
We can't. We can't.
Yeah.
So there's lots of that stuff.
This is a very unusual half hour of American network television. Yeah. This is an unusual show.
Yeah. We feel very lucky that we get to be any part of it. Yeah.
In Michael's office is a case of human objects. They were scotch tape, a pink pearl eraser, a slingshot, wax lips, a cheese grater. Was that a paper football for like tweaking? It looked like there's a white triangle that like you might fold paper in a classroom goals through someone's fingers.
Sure.
And of course, paper clips. These are obviously all clues to solve an escape room. Where did these come from? What else did you consider? Why these?
I mean, I think that was one of those things that it's fun to pitch on because the game is sort of like the banality of it is what is attractive to Michael in whatever way that he is so amazed by whatever thing that he's amazed by in human banality. I don't think we've ever named exactly where it comes from, but like, you know, it's interesting because those things were there even when he ostensibly was intending to torture the humans. But I think that it's also sort of a sign of what comes later that he is interested in them. Like every most of the things set up in that neighborhood at that time in the first season were to trick or torture the humans in some way. But he really is interested in that stuff. And I think, you know, on some level was not confronting the fact that he likes humans, even though, you know, he was sort of formed to hate them.
It really made us laugh that Micah would be obsessed with paperclips, mm-hmm. very specifically. And I don't think it made it in. I'm not even sure if we ended up shooting it. But there was a whole run where, like, Micah was like, look at these things. These are amazing. And Eleanor's like, oh, yeah, I used to do this. And she linked a couple of paperclips together to make a bracelet.
Sure.
And he was like, whoa, do that again.
I think he burst into tears.
Yeah, it was like the most amazing thing he had ever seen. And originally, I think she was going to make him a bracelet that he was going to, I think Mike said he's going to wear it for the rest of the series. Like, and, you know, obviously not really. But yeah, it was just a funny idea that came from somewhere. It was a good idea.
And now it resides in the candy bag.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Full episodes of The Good Place can be seen on NBC.com or the NBC app. But right now, let's listen to a clip.
So, to prepare to meet all of you, I studied the human concept of friends. I even watched all 10 seasons of the show, Friends. Boy, those friends really were friends, weren't they? Although, and I realize this is the kind of observation that would only occur to the mind of an eternal being, how did they afford that apartment? A waitress and a chef with those Manhattan real estate prices.
Yeah, we were all confused about that, too.
Anyway, it's been a tough couple of days. Right now, I could really use a friend by my side.
Well, you know me. The person who has audibly promised to help you.
Audibly. Audibly promised. I'm on the record as having promised. Are you fans of Friends? You two as people? You're both nodding.
I thought I was a fan of Friends. And then I met the rest of this staff. And they shamed me for how little I knew.
Is that right?
About Friends. Yeah, I think first season, Aisha Muhar, who mm-hmm. is an amazing writer, and she took what was labeled like an impossible to pass Friends quiz. No one gets 5%. She got it so easily, printed it out, took a photo. And I was like, well, I just thought that show was funny. So that's all I bring to that.
Your relationship
table.
With that show was more casual than you realized.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was something that tickled the room, you know, the idea of Michael being into Friends. But I think that was like a late-ish addition to the story where Mike saw like, oh, this is sort of like what we owe to each other and contractualism. There is so much. How can we help boil these ideas down even further? Like, let's just start talking about the idea of friendship and how new that would be to this version of Michael and how he could use it as a hot needle to torture Eleanor with. And yeah, it just kind of came together.
Yeah, and I think like it was also the beginning of the exploration of that Michael has kind of dual feelings about these people that he's torturing. Like his job is to make them miserable, but you know, and I don't think we've ever explicitly discussed this in the room, but like I think I choose to think that he was genuine in his interest and fascination with the show Friends. Mm-hmm. It was a fun. That I think that was around the time like we found the game of, in lots of contexts, Michael knows everything. And he knows everything that anyone's ever known, and he can understand more than anyone.
In a Janity way.
Like, yeah,
he's got
exactly.
The full accumulation of all history.
Yeah, but at the same time, like as he's exposed to humans and is interested in learning about them, he's sort of childlike in his wonder and grasp of just very basic concepts. Self-congratulation about making the observation that their apartment is too big, which is literally, I think, the billionth time that had been remarked upon.
It's the smartest and dumbest way that joke's ever been made, though.
Thank you.
I think is the top dead center sweet spot of this show. Simultaneously the smartest and dumbest.
The hope was to create a joke that would mean that observation was never spoken out loud again.
To hang a lantern on it so bright, though, as to say, like, I think it takes a, you know, whatever it was, afterlife mind, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Is pretty great.
Yeah, that was this guy.
It's also fun to that you guys get to dabble in the concepts of things. The concept, I think, of envy is the judge's salsa late in season two.
Yeah. And,
were they snorting or smoking the concept of time or something?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, and even in this episode, we get to like play with the idea that Michael, you know, can see in nine dimensions, and he says the room is messy because it's full of attention that only he can see. Mm-hmm. And then to immediately go from that to, I know how I'm going to use this big brain. I'm going to explain the show Friends to you in a way you've never ever heard before, and it is the way that literally everyone has always heard before. It's a fun roller coaster for that kind of thing. And yeah, you know, it's just, I think it's the best part about the show in writing it is you get to like, there's almost, as long as it doesn't like break the characters, there's so, you can dig into kind of any concept that you want, whether it's for an episode or a season or for just, you know, five or six words.
I was going to say, you can sort of parenthetical. I'm thinking of Jianyu, Jason on the massage table going like, well, Pitbull sort of broke. And it was like,
that's right.
Know, like, that's it's right. Almost a cutaway, almost like a, you know.
Yeah.
It's not, it impacts the situation, but it's harmless in a sense, you know.
Yeah, it's harmless. It's a shocking and fast way to understand something deep within that character's heart that, given the opportunity to talk about art in general, Pitbull is the first name on his mind.
Of course.
You know, we learn way too much about him in that moment.
Yeah, he was terrified to speak up until that point, but then he thought of Pitbull and was unable to stop himself from speaking.
It's like, oh, I know the right answer here. This is what she wants to hear. This is what I want to say. It's Pitbull.
How deep is the Bible on this? Like, do you guys know all nine dimensions? Have you discussed what they may be?
We have a guy on staff that probably has charted out all nine dimensions. That's Dan Schofield.
Really?
Yeah. Hopefully you'll get Dan on here.
Is Dan the one that does Sean?
I was hesitant to remind you of that, but yeah.
He reads in my voice at table reads when I'm not there, right?
That's right. Yes. That's right. He has, he's the only one who can get close. And, but yeah, Dan has a brain that is so astonishingly good at keeping us to our word in terms of mythology that we've set up and exploring what we think we meant when we pitched certain jokes and making sure, okay, but you know, we said you can only get here by this portal. So unless we just suddenly have a different portal, then, you know, and you're just like, okay, I guess we said that, sure. So he's probably a guy who's somewhere on his wall.
He's the Akashic Record logic cop.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that he is good at, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not even cop because he's also like so good at like pitching stories based on those things. And also just, you know, like everyone in that room is so good at pitching things out of the blue and great character moments and story turns and all that stuff. But he is well known for charting out certain things, and I bet that's one of them.
So I have a thousand things to ask you, but I do want to drill down on that just a little bit, because I feel like so much of the logic is watertight, like so much of it tells or whatever. But even visiting the room the other day, Mike brought up something that we'll see, and it doesn't matter what it is, but he said that they can't do this and they can't do this, and then finally somebody does do that. And I said, well, how did they do it? And he's like, I don't know, they hacked it or something. Like, you know what I mean? There's also the like, shut up, whatever kind of fix sometimes too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a balance. And I think that's what a lot of the back and forth is about because, you know, it's the concepts are really fun to play with and it's fun to pitch on jokes about snorting time. And at the same time, like on a certain level, there has to be some boundaries or else it's all nonsense.
Sure.
And it just says, okay, no that's stakes. A funny joke like, you it, made up.
It's not satisfying because there are no boundaries.
Yeah, and so we... You know, I think Mike is you know the ultimate keeper of it, of course, and like and does a good job of knowing when it's time to have fun and knowing when it's like, all right, that's super funny, but like it would just mean that the other stories we did like didn't make sense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've worked on things, you know, where where you're like, well, let's do the joke anyway because it's super funny. But like, you know, it means something. And I think, you know, people that are connected with this show, like, I think that's a big reason that it, you know, it means something to Mike. It means something to us. And
the rules of the game on this show matter more than they do in a present day 21st century North American real life sitcom, right? Like,
yeah, I mean partially
we're all in this escape room together. The audience, the humans, now Janet, now Michael, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of that comes from, I think, like the show gets to put its toes in so many different genres at the same time. And it's like, if this was just like a goof around show, if this was the show that people were tricked into believing it was in the first three episodes, mm-hmm. where it was just like, oh, we're in quote unquote heaven and there's sort of someone a little bit naughty there, then you probably wouldn't care so much that, oh, first they said trains and then they said portals and, right. and those sorts of things. But because we also are a little bit of a mystery box show and we're also occasionally a bit of like an exciting action show and we have set out a mystery, you know, just all of these different things together. It's like if we break our world to be funny for one sentence, we've done so much damage to the next 2 or 3 years of right. The story we want to tell. So
this has come up previously on this show. Those first three episodes, still a good show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, as you say, the premise may not have been captivating season after season after season or whatever. Although I would argue that the room I just walked into last week could figure that out as well. It's also, you know, a delightfully silly show. You wrote a bit where Lester the dog is overfed. I love the moment when Eleanor realizes, you know, having solved the problem of like, I'll just leave out all the food, goes like, wow, I'm ready to be a mom. Super yeah. parenthetical and great. But also later in the episode, did someone have to build a dog fat suit?
I think that was CGI.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So wait,
yeah,
did they sure. have to put tracking dots on a dog, like Andy Serkis dots on a dog?
That's a great question.
I want to say that they did, but
really?
It was a couple of years ago now. I remember being there for that. I remember, yeah, I think it was that we couldn't get a dog that was fat that looked like that dog, and I might be making this up completely.
That's a ridiculous endeavor.
It's a good narrative.
Like, I wouldn't yeah. even make that phone call.
Yeah.
Hi, it's me.
Yeah. No.
Can you infatuate the dog for us?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Do you have two dogs, identical in every way, but 40 pounds different?
Yeah.
That's a ridiculous ask.
Yeah. 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 But, you know, it was important to the story that we had a dog and then a much fatter version. Yeah.
Now, listeners, if one of the voices you're hearing sounds familiar, it's because Josh Siegel is not only one of the writers of The Good Place, he is also the star you know as Glenn. Josh, where have we seen Glenn before?
Glenn, bless his heart, has been, he gets up introduced in episode 3 of the first season when Eleanor and Tahani are investigating what's been happening in the neighborhood. They're talking to all the residents. You can see his face there.
My his.
And Glenn falls in the sinkhole.
That's
that
right.
was my first big stunt as a performer. And, you know, pops up now and then in season 1. In season 2, he is talking to a fire monster, and Chidi and Eleanor first smell smoke and then see them all together and realize, oh, no, this is the bad place, and take off for Mindy's. So he's been around a couple things.
How did that come up? Is this I did not delve into your IMDb. Are you an actor?
I'm not an actor.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of writer types who dabbled in it in high school
sure.
and college, realized we were not so good, mm-hmm. and then decided or were told to do writing instead. But, you know, one thing writers do on shows like this, or two things. One is in the room when you're pitching jokes, mm-hmm. you find your way to the voice of any character so that you can like make that joke funnier. Mm-hmm. So we all sort of do a version of that. And then occasionally we're asked to step in at table reads and play the parts that haven't been cast yet.
Mm-hmm. It's fun. I've seen Megan read for Maya Rudolph as the judge in episode a couple of seasons ago, and that was, or in season two. That was really fun.
Like, yeah, and Statsky has played many of the dirtbags we've seen on the show. She's has a gifted – she herself always wants to physically fight everyone, so it's nice to see that come through into characters.
We should get her on the show.
We should definitely. Well, unless it, we enjoy that she just never gets to be. So I stepped in and played Glenn the first time.
Great.
At the table read, and maybe had even been involved in, you know, pitching some of Glenn's lines. And someone had the idea.
You were about to say something terrible.
Yeah. Someone said oh, you should just do it.
Yeah.
And I said, ha, ha, ha. No, I don't have 99% of the tools required. So, but Mike, you know, came from The Office that had done this a bunch and really liked the idea. And then he said, you should do it. And I said, listen, try your best, cast someone great. And if you can't get anyone, then I will step in. So they cast someone else.
For real?
Yeah, for real. They cast someone else. And then the day before the shoot, this actor had a visa problem and couldn't come in from Canada or something.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the day before. And so he said, you're doing it. So suddenly I was Glenn. And at first it was like, oh, I just had one line. But then because of the rewrite, not because I was doing it, but just for different story reasons, the one line became a page of dialogue. And I'm there with Jamila and Kristen, and my friend Beth McCarthy Miller is directing. Mm-hmm. And I do my first take, and Beth comes in and she's like, Kristen, great. Jamila, great. Josh, couple things. She tells me like 16 things that I'm doing wrong in the scene. Like, this part's too fast, and this part's, you throw this away. And remember, you're, you know, and I was at this point, I was like, oh, the scene had changed where the character is sitting down. And I had to be like, oh, can I act sitting down? Like, I've never tried it before. I don't know.
Hilarious
if
question.
You teach that, you know. So
it's a postgraduate degree.
Yeah, great. I need to take whatever classes. The whole first day, I was convinced. I was like, this, I've done. I'm wasting everyone's
money and time.
I feel so bad. I apologized to Kristen, not just for that day, but also I apologized for every note I had given any actor ever.
Oh, wow.
Just to say like, oh, now I get it. I get it. Like somebody comes in and says, oh, do it all different, 100% all the way differently. And I felt bad. I donated to Kristen's favorite charity as an apology. I bought cookies for everyone. Like I felt, and of course, as I'm leaving, Jamila's like, oh, it's funny. It's like, this is my third week acting too.
Right.
And I'm like, thanks. Hey, thanks. but Mike liked it and put me in the next episode and has used me periodically. It's very nice of him.
As a impartial observer,
sure.
I would just like to point out that he downplayed greatly the amount of momentum behind the idea of casting him.
Okay.
The whole room was like, he has to do it. Mike was like, he has to do it. At one point, Mike said, are you okay with doing this? You're going to do it anyway. But like everyone knew he was going to be Glenn.
Sure.
And everyone had been arguing for it for a long time.
Some of this is just Mike paying it forward because, and I'll say this because my own nephew, who's a giant fan of all the shows in question, the Mike Schureverse, did not realize that Mike Schur was Cousin Moe's on The Office. Something that he did not want to do. I think that Greg Daniels did to him what he's now done to you, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so. But I remember, you know, before I, you know, I'd known the name Mike Schur, but it did not know what he looked like as a human.
Mm-hmm.
And then also watching The Office and feeling like Moe's was very funny.
Sure.
And then putting that together. But I don't have the same experience with myself. I don't watch myself and say, oh, you know what? He's actually a very gifted performer.
Stupid piece of garbage.
Yeah, it's like that.
I've worked with Glenn several times. Sean has worked with Glenn. And you're really good at it.
Oh,
yeah,
that's very
for real. Like
nice.
You found some, not found, like it's been there the whole time, like some optimistic, enthusiastic nebbishness. Like,
sure.
You know, it's really fun.
That's very, very, very kind.
Other writers and producers have been tucked into places in the show, too. I know that at the boardroom table, executive producer Morgan Sackett was with us at one point. I feel like Dan was sitting at a picnic table.
You're exactly right. Yeah.
In like a MOS montage or something, maybe a flashback.
Yeah. Statsky was a waitress.
Okay.
Joe Mandy was the voice of the fire monster.
Sure, who, still is.
Yeah, still is.
It's Todd, I think, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, Todd. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Mike sneaks people in there and doesn't do it if people aren't ready for it, except with me, where he made me do it.
But he knew you were ready. I will never get cast unless there is a character who is super unlikable and loud and only says two words.
That's impossible.
Yeah.
Finally today, Michael is trying to get to the bottom in this episode of what's gone wrong, and he's, you know, looking at every object and every possibility, finally considers people. But before that, he's looking at these rocks. And when he's looking at these rocks, he says, do any of these seem out of place? Do any of these seem sinister? You know, like they're taunting you, like they're always one step ahead. He's talking about himself, you devious little monsters. You knew that. The cast didn't know it beyond Kristen and Ted. How careful were you threading that line of like, we're going to plant this seed that you'll appreciate in hindsight later?
Yeah. I mean, you know, well, first and foremost, it was making us laugh, just purely the idea that, like, whether Michael believed it or was just going to sell to Eleanor that a rock could be suspicious. And it was a much longer scene where he's like, this one, man, I don't know about this one. Do you see what it's doing right now?
Look how he's looking at me.
Yeah. So it was such a long, lovely bit that he got to do and just dove headfirst into it. But Mike was always so protective of the twist and at the same time really wanted to play fair the whole first season so that people would go back and never say, we tipped it too far, so too many people figured it out. But also, we didn't hide it so well that people at the end were like, wait, that's not real. Like, right. They just made this up at the end. To the point where, like, I remember us having conversations about, did he talk about, like, not letting anyone wear red the first season, right? And then there was a purple dress, and he was not into it.
He vetoed a purple dress.
No, and he got talked to him. Everyone was like, I think Aisha specifically was like, purple's not red, Mike, stop it. And so
purple's
it was fine.
Not red daddy?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Probably.
I don't know if she was a daddy here. No.
It feels like, okay. No.
And I think one of the things about that moment that really stands up is that, you know, Mike, since we found out what was really happening in Michael's reveal, that, you know, part of the reason that he wanted to do this whole thing was that it would be more fun. That he is a burgeoning improviser, that he wants to like play things by ear and like an act sort of along with Wright, you know, in the way that he created a narrative that they would live out. Mm-hmm. And I think in that moment, he's really just having a good time. Like it's just for him. Like
it's torture.
Yeah.
He's getting her close and then backing off and then going, forget everything. It's a new thing.
Yeah.
And it's closer to you. It's a person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's this moment in this episode where after he is holding the minion stuffed animal.
Right.
And Eleanor says, great job, and turns to leave. And you can, when I watch it, you can see just 1 second of Ted allowing real Michael to slip onto his face. And I don't know if he was just tired that day and that's what happened. I don't know if we just left too much in. I don't know if it was just a choice to give a little taste of it or something, but it's wonderful. It's so worth watching, you know, just as a fan of the show as much as anything, to just see him sneak it in there. And hopefully when people go back and watch, they get to see all those little moments where he's enjoying himself.
Yeah, and that's something that was like really important to Ted throughout shooting everything was you know, even like there was lots of times where we'd be on set and we would just be like looking at the scene literally like this is what the jokes are. This is what's happening in this scene on the face of it to the audience at this point in this season. And he was always in the mindset of like, but I'm playing something in this. Like right. I'm
forking
with them.
Right.
And, you know, and he would pull us aside sometimes and be like, so how am I feeling
right.
this?
Yeah. Like,
shirt.
Right. That's what he's doing. But, you know, like, I think those pieces are there because they were really important to him. And and he did an awesome job.
I'm going to rewatch the Minions moment at my earliest convenience. I can't wait to see it. Dylan Morgan, what's good?
What's good is mental health professionals.
Yes.
And butts.
And butts.
Yeah.
I like it. I like it. Josh Siegel, same question. What's good?
This is going to feel like an ambush, but this is a pre-planned answer. I'm going to say this guy right here, Dylan Morgan, is good. He is, I have been grateful for our entire career together that I know exactly who the first audience for everything I write is going to be. And it's made me a better writer and a funnier writer. And I'm deeply grateful.
You should have gone first.
I'm so glad you went second.
Me too. Me too.
That's worked really out lovely, perfectly. And I appreciate it. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Hilarious episode, hilarious series. Can't wait to see what's in store.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Thank you for listening. Now go do something good.
Hi there. The podcast is over. I think what I'm feeling is sadness.
Oh, don't worry, Janet. This podcast is the most perfectly engineered invention since the paperclip.
Fun fact, the man who invented the paperclip is in The Bad Place for tax evasion.
It's available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop saying podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
Music composed by David Schwartz. Yay!